Get Lit.
Welcome back to Get Lit, the literary podcast where we discuss famous works of literature and the authors who wrote them. I'm your host, Steph Svars, joined here by my co-host,
John Stricker.
And we are back with another exciting author for all of you this week. Another author, actually, that I'm very excited to cover, much like Thornton Wilder from last week. But this week, we are going to be discussing Mary Heaton Vorse, who was one of the influential people behind the Provincetown Players, the theater group that I'm so fond of. And she is truly extraordinary. And I'm really hoping that this episode gets people excited to learn more about her legacy. So I'm very much looking forward to discussing her here. But first of all, a little bit more contemporary of news. John, could you bring us up to speed?
Yes, I have three very important stories to share with you, Stephanie. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, here it comes. I'm going to start off with the saddest of the news. Gary Paulsen, known for Hatchet, has died.
Yes.
He apparently had written over 200 books, which I didn't know about, but it sounds like he was incredibly prolific. Anyhow, I read Hatchet growing up. I don't know if you did, Stephanie. Did you?
No, I was actually inspired by his other books that involved Iditarod dog racing.
Yes,
and
that
he,
is.
He came to Naperville, actually, to speak. I don't know if you were at that, but when we were, like, in elementary school, I remember getting really excited to go see him. I think he might have been the first author, either him or Julie Andrews, who wrote a children's book with her daughter called Mandy. But both of them came into town with our local bookshop. And I just remember getting really, really excited about those events as a young person.
And I think that's one of the biggest things to take away about Paulsen is that young people were so excited about the work that he did. And he was one of the first authors I remember being really interested and excited to read. So we're very saddened by his passing. But just one quick fact about him. He gave an interview to the Times and he said two interesting things. One is he considered the internet to be just stupid faster, like a way to disseminate stupid things faster. So I thought that was funny. He considered himself a Luddite. And second of all, he said that the book that made the biggest impression on you, you probably read it before you hit puberty. So talking about the importance of YA authors. So I think that there's some truth in that.
Sure.
On to our second story. One of Spain's most popular female authors is actually three men. Just thought you'd like to know that.
What?
Yes. So these three middle-aged men had been writing under the pseudonym Carmen Mola, and her work had taken off in Spain. And her work was just awarded this million-euro prize. And then three middle-aged men claimed the pseudonym. And they have been writing collectively under the pseudonym to make these really popular works of fiction. So there are people on both sides of this debate. Some are like, you are like exploiting like a female pseudonym. And other people are like, it was a way for you to get your work out there without having your, personality be attached to it. Like so many other people have used pseudonyms for. So some people think they're scammers. Other people think that they're freed by this literary pseudonym.
Weird. It's definitely more fun the other way around, in my opinion. Well, good for them, I suppose.
Yeah, let's hear your takes, listeners. Lastly, there is a person that you might know called Solange Knowles. I believe that that's a famous musician, but anyhow, she's...
It's Beyonce's sister, John.
So this is Beyonce's sister, and she's launching a public library of rare and out-of-print Black poets, visual artists, designers, and luminaries. There's 50 titles, and you can go to the website, and you can choose a book. They'll mail it to you, and you get it for 75 days. You send it back with the return address they give to you, and you can rent these books absolutely free. So you just have to go to the website, which is sainthuron.com. It's a first come, first serve, starting the day that we're recording this episode Monday, October 18th. So listeners, I hope you're not too late, but if you want some rare out of print works that spotlight Black authors, I think that this would be an interesting way to maybe connect with books you won't find anywhere else.
All right. We're going to take a quick intermission recess, and I'm going to go on that website and get a couple books really quick. We'll be right back. That's absolutely amazing. Okay. We'll need to make sure that this resource gets out to everybody, because what a beautiful gift to be able to open that access back out. So thank you, Solange Knowles. What amazing work you're doing for so many people and so many authors' legacies as well. Very cool finds, John, this week. Thank you.
Thank you. It was all over the place and I couldn't just choose one.
Well, they were absolutely worth the reporting. Speaking of reporting, we're going to be talking about some Mary Heaton Vorse reporting. So let's turn it over to her to tell her story a little bit more. Mary Heaton was born in New York City on October 11th, 1874. So we just passed the anniversary of her birthday. And this, of course, makes her a Libra. But she is not on famousbirthdays.com, which, like any of the authors who wind up getting neglected by that site, is a gosh darn disservice. So I took the liberty of figuring some of her details out. Other famous people who were born in 1874 include Winston Churchill, Harry Houdini, the magician, Herbert Hoover, I think he was a president, Robert Frost, and Lucy Maud Montgomery, also known as Ellen Montgomery, the author of Anne of Green Gables.
There's her author connection.
Yes, so plenty of fun people in there. Other October 11th birthdays include Cardi B, Michelle Trachtenberg, the actress, and T.J. Watt, football player, and Joan Cusack was actually a lot further down the birthday rankings than I would have anticipated, but here we are.
She must not be famous on TikTok.
But she is a treasure, so. Anyway, Mary's mother inherited a very, very large fortune from her first husband, who was a wealthy shipping magnate. But unfortunately, he died. So, Mary's mother took the five children from that marriage, and she married Hiram Heaton, who was Mary's father, and Mary was the only child of that union. And the family lived very comfortably in their 24-room house in Amherst, Massachusetts.
Oh my gosh, some people.
Yes, so unlike a lot of the authors that we have reported on, she had a very luxurious childhood. You can go see, I think the house is still around today. If I'm remembering correctly, years ago, like maybe 6 or 7 years ago, when I first had graduated college, I went to look at grad school at University of Massachusetts, which is in Amherst, and I got to go see the houses out there, and I'm pretty sure I drove to see this house. So it's worth definitely another trip out there to investigate. But they didn't spend all of their time in Amherst, Massachusetts. No, instead, the family traveled all over Europe. Mary actually attends kindergarten in Hanover, Massachusetts, but then first grade in a grade school in Dresden and learned German.
That came out of nowhere, but how interesting.
Yes, she has a knack for learning languages and will eventually become fluent in German, French, and Italian. And after moving out of Germany, the family did several summers in Paris, and that is where Mary learned French.
So it sounds like she was able to be a world traveler from a young age to absorb some of these languages and make very good use of them.
Correct. And this is now, again, in the 1870s, 1880s. So this is a wildly inaccessible lifestyle for most people.
I mean, just to get over, it's like 2 weeks.
Exactly. So after this, she credits her interest in political and economic problems to her childhood. How, you say? Well, her mother used to read aloud from a book by the ethnographer George Kennan on the brutal Siberian penal system of Russia. And that got young Mary Heaton hooked on political and socioeconomic problems, along with classical Russian literature.
Stephanie, I'm not a parent, so I don't mean to judge another parent's decisions, but I feel like that might be a heavy book for a young child before bedtime.
Well, or conversely, maybe she chose it to put her to sleep faster, and it backfired, and Mary just got really interested in it. And her mom was like, I'm not doing this again. And she realizes she's already halfway through the book and her daughter really loves it. And so she pulls out Dr. Seuss and Mary is like, no, go back to the other one.
The penal colony.
Right.
Well, anyhow, Gitlet conspiracy. I hope it's true.
Wonderful. We will do the research. So, at the age of 16, she publishes her first short story. It wins like a local newspaper competition. So that's kind of her first foray into the writing world. But she has a real passion for art. So once she graduates from high school at the age of 19 in 1896, she starts to study at the Art Students League in New York City. And this was a very liberal kind of new institution at the time. It didn't have any entrance requirements, right? So lots of places would require some sort of portfolio, interview, grade, etc. And it also had no set course. So the progressive teaching methods and radical politics were something that really sparked Heaton's interest in all of this as she was growing up and kind of forming her identity, which is very cool.
Is it odd to you that the same things that were liberal then are still considered liberal now?
Sure, like a school with no set curriculum.
Right, like yeah. how edgy, and it's like this was early 1900s.
Correct. So she becomes friends with a lot of other students who also are activists, including Mae Wilson Preston, Alice Beach Winter, Ida Proper, and Lou Rogers, who were women's suffrage activists. And Mary starts to really become interested in these issues. And it almost takes over her ability to really focus on her art. But she winds up leaving the program because she realizes that she lacked artistic talent. So
wow. What a self-realization.
It's sad. So she wrote in her diary, quote, "When I come into my room and see my work lying around, my sense of my own futility overwhelms me. After so much work, that is all I can do." End quote.
I feel you, Mary. I'm right there with you.
What a wonderful poster that would be. That'll be our new Get Lit merch. We will be uploading that to our Redbubble store as a poster.
I'd like that in like high school classrooms, more like shoot for the moon. No. Futility
overwhelms me. So this realization, of course, is probably maybe one of the greatest gifts that we as a society has been given because of all the extraordinary things she did after kind of leaving art school. So in 1898, she marries the journalist Albert, who's called Bert Vorse, hence Mary Heaton Vorse. And they have a son together named Heaton, born in 1901. So I thought that was kind of interesting. So her son has her maiden name. So she
has a first name.
Correct. So it's Mary Heaton Vorse and her son Heaton Vorse. So Bert was assigned to Paris as a correspondent to the Philadelphia Ledger. And it was in France that Mary was actually encouraged by her husband to try writing professionally. So she starts out as a substitute book reviewer on the Criterion, which is actually a magazine that her husband edited. And this is where she launches really her official professional writing career. And she starts to create and sell romantic fiction to women's magazines. And these stories often featured rugged and energetic heroines who win the affection of like the prize coveted male figure over a more conventional woman. So these sort of, you know, exciting, thrilling romances that wind up getting her a lot of popularity as a writer and also a lot of money. So pretty quickly, she actually overtakes her husband as the more talented writer and the breadwinner of the family.
Wow.
So that was exciting. But unfortunately, this might have also contributed to the tension because she's not only doing all of this, but as a woman at the time is expected to do all of the housekeeping work as well and take care of the children. Bert didn't help matters because he started cheating on Mary as well. Mm. So in 1904, this marital tension is occurring. They try to solve it by having a baby.
I'm sure that works great.
Right. Well, he dies pretty soon after that. So don't worry. I'll just save everybody
the husband.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So before this, in 1904, they move to Venice, and Mary starts to get introduced to the working class labor struggle fight that's going on over there. And this will be something that really takes off when she moves back to the United States. So we'll get there. In 1906, however, they move to Provincetown, which is our connection, or my connection, to Mary Heaton Vorse. And in 1907, they have a girl who's named Mary.
I think that, you know, once keep you really simple. Like a name.
Yep. just it was helpful that she happened to have a male and female oriented or stereotypical names in her own name.
Right.
So she publishes her first book over there called The Breaking In of a Yachtsman's Wife in 1908. And then shortly thereafter, she publishes the autobiography of an elderly woman and stories of The Very Little Person in 1910. So The Very Little Person, I think, brings up a very interesting tension because it discusses this conundrum that a father has regarding his newborn daughter. And Mary Heaton Vorse emphasizes and kind of pokes fun of how little men were expected to know about children. Right. So women are the caretakers of everything. And this story kind of highlights the fact that men don't know anything about children and kind of how ridiculous that is when, you know, a parenting relationship is hypothetically 50-50. So she writes about that in that text, which I think is awesome. Again, this is 1910.
I think that's funny. And at the same time is still a trope that would land today.
100%. Absolutely. Maybe we can modernize it and write some kind of secondary piece, a companion piece to it.
Yes.
In 1910, she also joins the campaign to reduce the infant mortality rate in New York City. So one of the things that I think is really interesting about Mary Heaton Vorse in general, she comes from literally every privilege imaginable. She is worldly, she's well-traveled, she speaks languages, she's highly educated. And she uses all of these gifts that she has been given by her family to fight for people who did not have that background. And so all throughout her life, Mary Heaton Vorse is in the campaign. She's in the fight. She's not removed from the situation. And so I just kind of want to put that on the table for people to consider as we go through this and what it sort of means for her to be both exceptionally privileged and also use that privilege to help fight for all of these campaigns that mean so much to her.
She had every opportunity to choose not to engage with those topics, though.
Correct. So fortunately slash unfortunately, depending on your perception, and this is our perception, so it's colored, Albert Vorse dies in 1910. But what's worse is that the very next day, her mother dies of heart failure. Mm. So back-to-back losses there for Mary. Obviously, she's able to kind of pick herself up and move forward and continues her work reporting and getting involved with campaigns for women's rights and public safety. And she meets a journalist named Joseph O'Brien 2 years later. And they actually meet at the 1912 Lawrence textile strike. Are you familiar?
I'm not. Tell me more.
I was not either. So I was more, or I had more experience with the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. Excellent play written about that, actually, as well.
And terrible and, tragedy.
Right. And so this is very much along those lines. So this is a textile mill. And at the turn of the century, most of the workers in this were teenagers, and a lot of them are young women who don't really earn more than $2 or $3 a week. And they had to use most of that money, obviously, to pay rent. Women during this time, of course, were sexually exploited by their bosses, and obviously the working conditions were awful. So death by disease caused by working in these factories was also very common. A statistic that I found particularly shocking was that 36 out of every 100 men and women who worked in these mills died before the age of 25.
That's unforgivable.
That's over a third of the people who would work would die before the age of 25.
However much we see the current system is exploiting the workers, that's how far we've come.
Right.
There's ways to go, but at least we don't have nearly that statistic today.
Right. So this is actually kind of the problematic space that Mary tries to report on. So she's a journalist. She meets Joseph O'Brien, the journalist, and she actually writes a really amazing and influential account of the Lawrence textile strike. And it's through this connection that O'Brien and Vorse actually wind up falling in love and getting married. So by all accounts, and I also read her autobiography, Joe seemed to kind of be like the love maybe or true love partner of her life. Unfortunately, this won't be very long lived either, but they get married in 1912, 3 months after they met. So it was very quick.
When you know, you know, Stephanie.
I guess so. But he was joyful and exciting. He loved the idea of a family. So he actually helped raise Mary's two other children from her first marriage. And they had a son of their own together. And he was gregarious and funny and told stories and things like that. And it seemed like it was a very productive and beautiful relationship. Unfortunately, by 1915, Joseph O'Brien was plagued by an illness that we know now today to be stomach cancer. And so after just 5 years of being together, Joseph O'Brien dies in 1915, and Mary Heaton Vorse becomes a widow for the second time.
That's heartbreaking.
Yes. So it's through, again, her connections to the working class, to these politically active protesters and influential writers and thinkers in society that lead her to get to know Floyd Dell, George Jigg, Cram Cook, John Reed, Louise Bryant, Susan Glass-Bell, Eugene O'Neill, and Edna St. Vincent Millay. And it's her donation of the wharf, the Lewis Wharf in Provincetown, that gave the Provincetown Players their first space outside of a home to perform their theater performances.
So is it fair to say she was the big pockets of the yes. Players?
Okay. Yes, it is. So Mary Heaton Vorse owned, I can't actually remember why she owned the wharf, but she owned Lewis Wharf. And when all of these people kind of came to start summering with her, because again, she'd been going to Provincetown since about 1906. And this is 10, 11 years later, when all of these people come together to spend their summers with her. She actually donates the use of that space and was incredibly supportive of all of the work that they were doing. A lot of the Provincetown Players were involved in the same social issues that she was. And so it's not, you know, I think shocking at all to know that this was very much a part of her work, I think, to get new ideas out in the open and things like that. So I really like her involvement in the Provincetown Players as well.
Right. And I mean, without her financial support, we may never have gotten Long Day's Journey into Night.
Right. Slash any of the other very important pieces of the Provincetown Players. So the First World War begins, and Mary Heaton Vorse was on the pacifist side and really wanted to bring about peace. And so on January 10th of 1915, 3,000 women attend a meeting in the ballroom of the New Willard Hotel in Washington and form the Women's Peace Party. Jane Addams is elected the chairman or chairwoman. And Aletta Jacobs invites in April, she's a suffragist who lives in Holland, some of the members of the Women's Peace Party to attend the International Congress of Women in The Hague. And Mary Heaton Vorse is one of the representatives selected to go,
Wow.
I know. Isn't that amazing? So she's over there fighting for women's suffrage rights. She's working with labor rights and problems and things like that. And also works for the radical journal called The Masses. Again, a Greenwich Village, incredibly important publication for the Bohemian culture during this time. That is a Jack Reed, Max Eastman kind of creation. And it's forced to close during the war, but from 1912 until 1917, Mary Heaton Vorse not only wrote for it, but also helped edit and put it together.
Wow.
Right. So not much slows her down.
No, not even a little.
Right. So in this, she publishes all different kinds of articles on child labor, infant mortality rates, labor disputes, working class housing. And these get published not only in The Masses, but also in the New York Post and the New York World. She was one of the few leftists that would get published in these more centrist papers, which again is pretty remarkable, demonstrating, I think, her handle of language and being able to frame ideas. I don't know that palatable is necessarily the right word, but in a way that brought people together to understand the plight of others.
And again, putting herself out there with her connections, the fact that she could probably get audiences with these newspapers and not shying away from her ideals or trying to blend into an upper crust society, like, she put herself out there.
Yes, and will continue to do so. And I have some cool stories about that later. So in 1920, Mary Heaton Vorse starts a relationship with Robert Minor, who's a cartoonist and also a founding member of the American Communist Party. So that's kind of fun.
Sure.
Right. Well, unfortunately, this will not go very well. She suffers a miscarriage in 1922, and Minor leaves her for an illustrator named Lydia Gibson. They get married in 1923. Mm. So the trauma, right, coupled of those two events, starts Mary on an addiction to alcohol and morphine. And she, in 1924, writes an essay called Why I Have Failed as a Mother. And this is less about how maybe literal failure, but rather writing about the difficulty and the struggle between motherhood and work, right? So we, you know, this is also something that I think could land today. But women who struggle with being mothers, full-time job, right? It's incredibly difficult, especially at this time where men weren't really expected to do much in the family relationship. That wasn't necessarily their domain. So Mary Heaton Vorse, who's out working, raising money, writing, she's fighting for rights, all kinds of things like that. On top of that, also really struggles to pay attention to her children. And as a mother, how difficult that was. So she was able to kind of break this habit, however, in 1926 and return to her writing. And her writing was made maybe better, more powerful, or more of her own, because she actually participated in the strikes and worked with unions. So again, at this time, it wouldn't be that uncommon to just read reflections of something that happened from afar. Person wouldn't even really need to experience it, right? I'm thinking of even armchair travel and how many writers that we've done in the past that had never really been to the places that they were writing about. But she was able to do this because she actually participated in the strikes. She was wounded in 1937 by a bullet because she was shot by vigilantes at the Ohio steel strike.
No way.
Obviously survived, but that's like a fun little detail to throw in there.
I mean, that's a testament to her dedication.
Right. And so I just want to put this out there. It's 1937. Right before World War II.
Right.
At least in terms of American involvement and that sort of thing. But she was thought to be the oldest American foreign correspondent at 71 when the war ended. So she got shot by vigilantes when she was in her 60s and then went over to a war zone to serve as a correspondent until the age of 71.
Nothing stops this woman.
Exactly. So as much as people like praise the founding fathers and like Alexander Hamilton, because he was prolific as well, I don't know. Mary Heaton Vorse might have something on these guys. She published over the course of her life over 400 articles in America's leading journals, including McClure's Magazine, Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, Harper's Weekly, New Republic, and the Ladies' Home Journal. She published 18 books and two plays, along with several memoirs and an autobiography.
Wow.
So that's, you know, that's her contribution. In 1962, at the age of 88, she becomes the first recipient of the United Auto Workers Social Justice Award for her work as a labor journalist in the 1920s and 30s, which, again, just remarkable. I think that is just so cool.
Absolutely.
Right? After all, like, 20s to 60, 40 years later, 30, 40 years later, she's getting honored and celebrated by the United Auto Workers.
In her time, which is even cooler.
Right. So Mary Heaton Vorse dies of a heart attack on June 14th, 1966 at her home in Provincetown, Massachusetts, where she'd lived on and off for over 30 years. And she is buried in Provincetown today. Now, John and I worked very hard. And I think when we recorded one of our, maybe it was Susan Glassbell's episode or Eugene O'Neill, when we were actually in Provincetown, we spent several hours searching for her grave, both at night and during the day, and were not able to find it. So John and I will definitely be on another quest to find Mary Heaton Vorse's grave in Provincetown. If any listeners have any connection that could help us find it, the issue that we had was that we were using, you know, plot numbers and things like that, and we weren't able to just quite locate it. So, yeah, that was several
hours. We gave it a real college try, too. Like, we asked people, we went multiple times, but we were unsuccessful.
So, that'll be our next effort. But speaking of ghosts, sort of, cemeteries, there's a connection. She wrote several ghost stories as well, including one called The Second Wife, and those were all collected and published later together as Sinister Romance Collected Ghost Stories. So, I will be looking to procure a copy of that. Her legacy obviously lives on today. Lots of journalists sort of credit her with being the most important labor journalist of all time. I mean, the work that she did for women, for people living in poverty, for children and child labor, for women's, not only suffrage, of course, but women's health is incredibly important. And without her efforts in the 1920s and 30s, really when things are starting to change socially for women's standing, I don't know that we would have the same knowledge and awareness of what was going on today. So you can go see many of the famous and influential places that Mary Heaton Vorse lived in, worked in, resided in, including in Provincetown. So another final anecdote, John and I took John on a Provincetown house stalking tour while we were there. And we went to, you know, Eugene O'Neill's house, Susan Glassbell's house, Jack Reed's house. You can also go see Mary Heaton Vorse's home. And it was purchased several years ago after we were there. It was actually on the market, if I'm remembering correctly, while we were there. And it was purchased by an interior designer named Ken Folk, who opened in 2020, July 2nd to be precise, a space to help foster an artist's colony in the home. So he is very famous and well known. He has a beautiful Instagram page. But he does a lot of work restoring old houses. So rather than, you know, creating spaces that are totally new with, you know, open floor plans and very large designer farmhouse kitchens, he celebrates, I think one of the words or phrases he used was the patina of life in these homes. And so the pictures of his final interior design work in Mary Heaton Vorse's house is stunning. It's beautiful. It really celebrates the heritage of her home and her building. And so he has kind of put together this to fight the gentrification that happens in Provincetown, which if any of you have been to Provincetown, you know it's very much a tourist destination. Most of the people who own property there, it's a second home for them, or they rent it out. So there are only about 3,000 full-time residents year-round in Provincetown, and that number expands to about 60,000 during the summers. And artists, Provincetown, right, was originally founded as an artist colony, isn't really able to sustain the same kind of gritty, creative, and maybe stark feeling that it originally had. People went to Provincetown for the light and the beauty. And really, a lot of that hasn't been able to be maintained because it's so expensive and artists can't afford, you know, to spend weeks at a time there because it's just not feasible.
Have something to say about that, Stephanie?
Yes.
Mary Heaton Voice.
You know, I think she might. And so I think it's really amazing that her house is now kind of an open arts colony. There's 8 bedrooms meant to help kind of foster the art culture that hopefully won't be lost. And that makes Provincetown so special to so many people. So my apologies for a long ending diatribe, but that is the exceptional, incredible life of Mary Heaton Vorse, labor activist and journalist, in addition to a novelist, an all around extraordinary woman.
Thank you, Stephanie. Every time you tell me about Mary Heaton Vorse, I learned something new, and I have another reason to look up to her. So what an incredible story.
I'm glad. I'm really glad to hear that. I think she has a remarkable legacy, and I'm glad that this could maybe be something that will help people learn more about her. So in the meantime, listeners, before we see you in the future, I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I hope it taught you something new or led you to get inspired in one way, shape, or another to fight for the things that are important to you. So until we see you next time, thank you, of course, for your support of this podcast, and thank you, as always, for keeping it lit. There's one.